Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, August 14th, 2020, a somewhat overcast day here in Music City. Okay, here's a fact that I find to be true. Protecting the environment, clean air and clean water, can't be done on the honor system. It takes strong and effective laws, regulations, and enforcement. So, if you want to have clean water to drink, or to paddle in, or fish in, you must elect persons to public office who are actually committed to that goal, and who know something about it. That being established, it is comparatively rare to see political candidates emerge from the ranks of environmental activists. Very rare indeed to find a candidate for Congress who can speak with authority and experience about the details of environmental policy. My interview today is with just such a person, practical-minded and seasoned in the rough and tumble of bringing polluters to account, impeccably knowledgeable in the technical aspects of environmental conservation. Rene Hoyos is a Democratic candidate for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District of Tennessee. This district includes Knoxville and several rural counties to the north and south of Knoxville. It is an area of the world with world-class natural beauty, worthy of conservation, which unfortunately has seen more than its fair share of environmental insults. We had some fun today talking about a wide range of topics. I hope you'll enjoy this interview with the energetic Rene Hoyos. Rene Hoyos, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled. First of all, congratulations to you on your nomination as the candidate for the 2nd District, Tennessee Congressional 2nd District Democratic candidate.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a good race, and we did really well. In fact, I got the highest percentage of votes of any candidate running on the Democratic ticket in Tennessee. So
that's great news. And you were unopposed in the primary.
I was, but his name was on the ballot, Chance Brown. He's since joined the campaign.
So there was another person on the ballot. I didn't understand that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But you did get a lot of votes, and that's the key.
Yes.
Now, this is your second time to run for this position. Is that correct?
That's right. I ran in 2018. It was an open seat at the time. Congressman Jimmy Duncan had retired. And we did really well. I mean, it was a grassroots, bootstrapped campaign, and we moved the district almost 19 points. So it put this district in the top 35 of districts to move towards Democrats in the country.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. Now, I first came to know about you. I've been involved in conservation and conservation issues for many, many years. And I learned about your involvement with the Clean Water Alliance. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that and how you came to Tennessee and your background in environmental work.
Yeah, well, I was at the University of California, Davis. I have a degree in avian sciences, where I studied neurobiology and neuroendocrinology. But I was also a whitewater rafting guide and got really interested in water issues in California and became, worked in Governor Gray Davis's administration as a watershed analyst for the state, for an appointee. And then, Arnold Schwarzenegger announced his candidacy on Jay Leno. And I thought, I was going to lose my job, so I started looking around, and I found this job at the Tennessee Clean Water Network, and they took me, and I loved every minute of my time there. It was a great organization, small, scruffy. We did a lot of lawsuits. We sued lots of polluters into compliance, and I learned a lot about legislation and regulation and litigation and how all of it is entwined to protect our natural resources.
Rene, that's so interesting. You know, I graduated high school in 1970, so you're senior by a decade or two, maybe. But at that time, we had the Cuyahoga River catch on fire in Cleveland, Ohio, and then in
72, I guess we had the Clean Water Act, and 74, the Endangered Species Act. Those things were inspiring to me. Some of those things were, for instance, clean water is something that's more regulatory in a lot of ways than it is promotional about the environment. So it sometimes lets your eyes gloss over when you think about all the tedious issues involved with that. But the improvement in the environment that has happened since that time is just outstanding.
I mean, the Cuyahoga was not the only river catching on fire. We had pollution events happening with alarming frequency. There was an oil spill on the coast of California, and lots of rivers were catching on fire. The Tennessee was in terrible, terrible shape. People didn't boat recreationally on any of the rivers out here. It was taking your life in your hands.
I was living in Cincinnati at the time, and the Ohio River was basically a sewer. And it's cleaned up to a great extent now. I mean, you can eat the fish there if you dare,
Occasionally.
but I suspect though that we're losing a lot of the value that has been obtained through those acts with this administration that we have in Washington right now.
I also want to point out that we've been losing the war on the environment for many years. This current administration is dramatic and sweeping, but it was set up by previous generations, and I used to say that the environment is nonpartisan. Nobody wants to deal with it. I mean, it was a little better under the Clintons, but not that much. And it was a little bit better under Obama, but not that much. And the thing is, we've got to start taking the environment a lot more seriously than we're taking it now. And a lot of the laws that are being struck down are being held up in litigation, and that's great. We're going to have some protection with the courts for a while. But the truth is, all of our environmental laws do need to be updated, and everybody's terrified to do it. Industry thinks environmentalists will have their way and make everything, unattainable. And environmentalists are concerned that industry is going to win the day and weaken everything. And the farmers are concerned that they're going to get regulated. And so it's very hard to have a good conversation about the environment because everybody's really turfed out.
In what ways do the laws need to be updated?
Well, for example, the Clean Water Act, it had some updates in the 80s, but water quality and water science has changed quite a bit since then. And we have pharmaceuticals now that we know that are causing a problem,
And
microplastics.
microplastics, right?
All of these, there's a number of things that, new chemicals, and with EPA being so defunded, we're not getting the science we need when new chemicals come out. We don't know how all these chemicals interact once they're in the water. Are there synergistic effects? So, there's just a lot of stuff that needs to be looked at, and our permitting system needs to be overhauled, I think. And there needs to be more enforcement, quite frankly. And and as much as I say that, I understand that farmers are concerned about being regulated, and currently agriculture is exempt from the Clean Water Act unless you are a factory farm with a certain number of animals. And I do not want to regulate a small farm, but some of these big companies that own, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of acres nationwide, do need to come under regulation.
Sure, and these are the pig farms and the dairy farms that have a lot of animals and a lot of waste material that they have to deal with.
Yeah, and there's new technologies. In fact, I know of one pig farm that was required to reuse the methane from the pond that they use to hold manure, and that methane was required to be used to run operations. And so, there's new technologies out there. People are so afraid of regulation, but what it does is it spurs jobs and it spurs technology. And we just, don't see the forest for the trees here when it comes to that kind of thing. But I think it's important that we hold polluters accountable, and we use technology to make our planet cleaner.
So your district is the second district of Tennessee. And for our listeners that may not be from Tennessee, I know that it includes Knoxville. Is it all of Knox County, or is it just portion of Knox County?
Yeah, it's Knox County, Blunt County, Loudoun County, right. Jefferson.
Which are south of Knoxville, right?
South of Knoxville. And then you go north to northeast Jefferson, Granger, Claiborne, and just a sliver of Campbell. And actually, about three quarters of Jefferson, I don't have white pine.
I see.
So it's a very interesting mix of urban and rural. Right. And, the issues are, we think they're different, but they're actually very, very interrelated and tied up. So, for example, with hospital closures, in rural areas, it means that you may drive a lot farther to get to a hospital. In urban areas, a hospital closure means everybody waits longer in the emergency room.
Right, right.
And so, nobody's benefiting from hospital closures.
Right.
And so, healthcare is one of my number one priorities.
So healthcare, and I've noticed that housing is on your list of important priorities.
Yeah, we have a lack of affordable housing.
Right.
And we are losing housing affordability. And by that, I mean homes that you can purchase with a median income job now. And our median house price is probably doubled since I moved here in 2003. I bought a little house for $74,000 in Oakwood Lincoln Park, which is a very working class neighborhood, little two bedroom, one bath gem that I loved. And houses in that street are now going for almost
$200,000. Wow.
And I remember thinking, boy, if things don't work out at the network, I could get a job waiting tables and I could still make my mortgage. Well, that doesn't happen anymore.
Not anymore, you know? Right.
Not anymore. And we really need to take a hard look at why we don't have affordable housing. And a lot of it is we don't incentivize it for developers. We don't incentivize that kind of thing.
Tell us more what you mean by that.
Well, there used to be a lot of government grants, federal housing grants that said, we can give you this pot of money if you agree to have. Now, often it would say low income housing. And and the thing was, like, they would say you could keep this house in low-income housing for 5 years, and then after 5 years, the owner can turn around and sell it at market. And so for a few years, you'd have, people getting in on the ground floor to get housing, which is so important. I mean, if you have a house, if you have solid housing, you are better set up for life.
Right.
But there was really nothing to keep those subdivisions affordable. And so people would make all these improvements, or the housing prices would just go up as a matter of course. And then suddenly people like me who are median income can no longer get into it, or they do get into it and just are terrified every month that they're going to lose their job and not be able to make their mortgage. And we do need to make housing affordable and accessible for people of all income ranges, but particularly for people that are working class and people that are poor.
Right. Looking at your district, we have some of the most rural areas in Tennessee that you've described. I mean, Granger and the north, particularly those that are north of Knoxville there that you've described, are very rural. We have a lot of abandoned mines up there as well. Mm-hmm. Are the people you're speaking to talking about the same issues in those rural areas as they are in the urban areas?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks up there are concerned about job opportunities.
Okay.
That have been, not in some cases, not slowly. I mean, there haven't been good coal jobs in Claiborne County for a couple of decades. I mean, if there's 20 people working in coal mines before the virus, I'd be surprised.
Right.
The coal really hasn't been that big of an option in these counties as much as it was, 20, 30 years ago. But unfortunately, nothing has come along to replace it.
Right.
And that's why I'm really pretty passionate about a transition to renewable energies that can use the areas that we have used for mining and create jobs, have the ability to provide work that's safe and that contributes to an energy economy. These are good outdoor jobs if we can get them for folks that, a lot of those miners, it's really hard to transition from mining to coding or mining to, you know, a job in the medical field,
sure,
you know?
Sure,
so
sure.
You really want to try to find a transitional job that can have, you can use their skills and their, you know, people think miners just dig, but there's a lot of skill involved in coal mining,
sure,
especially these days. And so you want to keep that skill set and you want to keep families in their communities. And if we can find a way to do that, it just makes our rural communities more robust. Not everybody wants to live in the city. And, you know, you should be able to have a decent way of life and have the benefits of having your family around you.
Right.
And having that network in place. So I'm very committed to looking for opportunities for our rural communities to have that kind of stability.
You know, some of those opportunities may be in outdoor recreation as an industry, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a fair amount of that work going on in the Cumberland Plateau.
Right.
And a lot of counties have really worked hard to create trail systems. And there's a lot of whitewater rafting, climbing on the plateau. There's a lot of opportunities for that as well. The jobs tend to be more low income because they're kind of service oriented.
Right.
And so it's hard, you know, they're low income, no benefit jobs. And so I really want to see more industry. In fact, there was a bill at the legislature that would give rural entrepreneurs the same advantage as minority and women owned business in federal projects.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, something I would have signed on immediately. My opponent, Tim Burchett, voted against it. I'm not quite sure why. There was no money. It just simply added rural entrepreneurs into the list of jobs that you could get. And I thought, what a great opportunity to get to the chambers and say, let's see if we can get some educational grants into these communities and get people coming up with their own businesses. There's lots of tradespeople that live in these counties.
Right.
And get them, you know, up to speed so that they can apply for these jobs in, you know, Anderson County or Knox County or Loudoun County and get them employed.
Right. You know, the Congress has recently passed and our president has signed into law the Great Americans Outdoor Act, which really, I guess, is one of the few bipartisan accomplishments that we've had in the last few years that relates to the environment. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we love our parks. And especially here in the 2nd District, I have a section of the Great Smokies in the district. And, you know, the enabling legislation for the Smokies was you were never to charge a fee to enter the park. And it's the only park that is free in the country. And it has the highest visitation as a result. And
right.
I love the Smokies.
Right.
But over the years, you know, with budget cuts and this drive for smaller government, infrastructure projects have been deferred and delayed in
right.
the park. And that can be a danger to the visitors. And so, you know, if you go to the Sugarlands, the Sugarlands Center, you can see that it could benefit from some upgrade. I mean, I think it was built in the 40s or 50s, and it's, you know, still operating on that technology, and it needs to be upgraded so that people can have the kind of experience in the park that makes them want to support parks more.
Right.
So I was thrilled, and, you know, I want to thank Congressman Burgett for signing that. I think it was, like you said, it was one of the few bipartisan things that's been passed, and it was overdue and long needed. For
yeah,
sure.
I think our congressional delegation statewide, Senator Blackburn was the only no vote on that bill, and I, you know, it was disappointing to a lot of the outdoor advocates, and I've heard particularly from what I call the hook and bullet groups, the hunters and fishermen. About how disappointed they are in her vote on that bill.
Yeah, she I lobbied her for years on clean water issues, and she was a big supporter of the Wolf River Trail in Shelby County, which is going to be probably one of the longest greenways in
right.
Tennessee, if not
right.
in the South.
Right.
She was a big supporter of that and voted often for federal funding for it. So I, you know, I don't know what happened to her, but she used to be a real supporter of those kinds of projects.
You know, across Tennessee, the Land and Water Conservation Fund has been very important to state government in acquisition of lands for new parks, and also to local government for park acquisition and some development. And this new bill fully funds that program for the first time since 1964, when it was created. It's the first time it's been fully funded. And really, I think it's going to provide for a revitalization of our urban parks and even parks in your rural counties.
It is really well needed. There have been studies that show that young people now are looking at the built and the non-built environment when they make a choice to relocate. And I know Memphis spent a lot of time on this because they really were having a brain drain there, that people would come and study at the University of Memphis or at Rhodes and then leave. And one of the complaints was, there's nothing to do here.
Right.
And Memphis really worked hard to provide some outdoor activities for young people there as a means of getting talent and keeping it.
Right.
And, you know, when you invest in your parks, it's good for so many things, you know, mental health, physical health. Keeping a tree cover is great for, you know, changing climates. And our urban areas in particular suffer from not having that kind of cover and not having a place where people can go and enjoy the benefits of being in the outdoors. And when I was at the network, we worked on a park that is in East Knoxville. It's called the Williams Creek Urban Forest. And we were able to get about 10 acres in downtown East Knoxville and carve it out for a park. And it's still not been developed.
Right.
But it is vacant. It cannot be ever developed for housing or business. It's under a conservation easement. And it's one of the things that I was really proud of, because East Knoxville has so little park compared to the rest of the city.
Renee, is this the little area where y'all got a bunch of goats to clear out some of the underbrush?
Oh yeah, the goat project was the funnest thing I ever did. In fact, you know, I've been joking that when I retire, I'm going to get a goat farm. Because I had just a great time dealing with the goats and
people,
the dog.
Go onto YouTube and just enter a search for Knoxville goats clearing brush or something, and this will come up. And it is one of the coolest demonstrations, really, mm-hmm. about how to economically remove invasive exotic plants.
And the neighbors loved it.
Right.
I mean, occasionally the goats did get out, and they did eat some neighbors' yards.
Right.
That's a hazard when you're dealing with goats.
All right.
But the community had my phone number. And if there was ever, like if they had not seen the dog in 4 hours, I got a phone call. And so they just loved having the goats out there and having, you know, just some attention paid to this area.
Right.
And these were all does and their babies. So they were fun to watch and they weren't particularly stinky.
Right.
They weren't particularly loud, and they would party with the neighbors. I went out one time in the middle of the night. There'd been a call that the dog was missing, and it was August, and everybody's had their music playing, and all the goats were hanging around, you know, they were up until late at night. Then when I went to feed them at 10 o'clock in the morning, they were all sound asleep in the sun.
Oh, that's fun.
For a night of partying.
So getting back to the point about urban parks, you know, I'm here in Nashville and been here for 40 years. Nashville is blessed with a wonderful park system. Memphis also. Chattanooga and Knoxville, not so much. Uh-huh. They've been seemingly digging out from the remains of their industrialization, early industrialization, and it's. They really have never got into the urban park movement.
Actually, you know, Knoxville has hundreds of acres. It's called the South Knox Urban Forest.
Okay.
Hundreds and hundreds of trail miles.
Okay.
A big section. It was Legacy Parks Foundation worked tirelessly to acquire properties on the south side of the river. We have an enormous urban park system here.
Please understand, I think they're making progress. But they've got a long way to go to really bring it up to what I would consider desirable.
Oh, Well, interesting. Have you been to the urban wilderness here?
Not that I recall, no. It's not
Ah,
that I
okay.
recall.
Yeah. Well, the next time you come, do check it out. It's an amazing. I mean, I trained for an ultra race on the trails out here and never had to run the same trail, twice.
Yeah, it's been a number of years ago, but I had a contract to do an audit of the city of Knoxville's parks, and went around, visited each of their parks, and they were del at that time they were a lot of them dilapidated in great need of repair, and they were small, so I know that they've made progress. That's been a goal of theirs, but well, they do have a long way to go. And the point of that, making that point, is this funding that is will be available through this American Outdoors Act, it could be really important for Knoxville.
Oh yeah, and all the counties here in the second district
Right.
can have access to that. And people always want to have a lot of parks, but they don't want to pay for it. And I think people's minds are being changed now when they see how much infrastructure improvements need to happen, in general, and are understanding now that you don't get it. There's nothing for free, so you're going to need to pay for it. And I'm glad to see that they've opened their wallets for this project.
Renee, I wanted to get back to water quality. Read recently that there's an outfit called the French Broad River Keeper, and I have only become recently aware of their organization. But apparently, there is an issue with the water quality in the French Broad that flows through Jefferson County and Douglas Lake and down through into Knoxville. With the discharge of effluent, I guess they believe it's coming from the city of Asheville, North Carolina. Is that something you're familiar with, or
Oh yeah.
yeah?
We tried to get to Asheville. We actually, I want to say maybe in 2010, increased our boundaries to include all the watersheds of the rivers that go through Tennessee. So
Okay.
that gave us access to Alabama and North Carolina and some of Kentucky, a little bit of Arkansas. We checked out the Asheville treatment plant several times and we couldn't find anything. Now we had
Okay.
now, mind you, this would have been 5 years ago,
Okay.
at least. But there were lots of complaints of sewer overflows.
Right.
And I've spent a lot of time on the French Broad, and I always saw these big foamy biscuits. And usually those foamy biscuits do not appear naturally. They are a result of some kind of pollution event.
Okay.
And the only big discharger was really the city of Asheville.
Right.
And but we just could not, we couldn't find a connection back then, but who knows? I mean, if it was starting to deteriorate 5 years ago, I guarantee you it's a wreck now.
So
And
what is the status of the sewer systems that feed into the Tennessee up in that area? So you have in Nashville, we have a legacy of older systems that were combined storm and septic systems that we're now having to separate those. In fact, we're under a consent decree with the EPA to do that here, but it's extraordinarily expensive. What's the status of that kind of issue up in Upper East Tennessee?
Well, we sued all of the major dischargers into compliance the years that I was the executive director at the Tennessee Clean Water Network. So we did Madisonville, KUB, Knoxville Utility Board, City of Chattanooga, and we also did the City of Memphis. We intervened in a case there.
Okay.
And the city, not you still have to monitor. KUB has done pretty well. Occasionally I'll find an overflow, but that's to be expected. These systems are constantly breaking and needing to be fixed. Dandridge was a big polluter for a while, but they have a
Okay.
new sewage treatment plant that went online a few years ago. Madisonville has a new treatment plant for the Teleco area. And so water quality, I think, is improved. When we stopped suing, we had sued all the major non-compliers. And what we were left with were tiny municipalities like, we used to joke about this, the city of Friendship, in non-compliance for 12 quarters, non-compliance. They basically have a settling pond. And, you know, the same kind of thing
that was their treatment plant, right?
That was their treatment plant.
Right.
And what they needed was economic development, not a lawsuit. And we were not going to sue these tiny municipalities because of, you know, of course, in that case, it would be TCWM versus Friendship.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh, yeah, that just looks terrible. But a lot of small municipalities, and we tried to work with companies to get, you know, maybe some new technology. And it was just really hard because so many of the state organizations don't talk to each other very well. So TDEC wasn't looking at this as a holistic problem, saying, wow, we have all these non-compliant small cities. We need to have a program to figure out how to get them in compliance. And one of the programs was the State Revolving Fund, which gives low interest grants.
Okay.
Well, you know who gets the most low interest grants?
No.
Williamson County.
Oh, I see.
Because they have consultants that can write fancy proposals.
Sure.
And so, but we were like, no, Williamson County can afford to clean this up. Friendship cannot afford. There's 300 people live in Friendship.
Very good point.
You know, they need this grant, not Williamson County.
Right.
And so it was just, you know, it was something that was a little bit past our mission, economic development. It was something we didn't have any experience in the office in, and I was too overloaded to try to take it on as another subject. But I did really see the importance of how our state government agencies need to talk to each other at least a little bit more.
Right, right. When I first came to Tennessee, I worked for the city of Gatlinburg.
Mm.
This was 1975, 1976. And very shortly after going to work for the city as Parks and Rec director, the city was put under a building moratorium. The Department of Environment in those days, I guess it was the Department of Health put a moratorium on new construction and new sewer taps in Gatlinburg until they built a new sewer plant. Because they were dumping raw sewage into the Little Pigeon River there as it ran from Gatlinburg through the spur and into Pigeon Forge. And they ultimately got a huge EPA grant, a 90% funding grant from EPA to build their new sewer plant, which of course is at capacity or over capacity again now. But my point of my story is, it seems to me that the pie needs to be bigger for those sorts of grant projects. Developing sewers and water systems is one of the most expensive things that municipalities do.
Yeah, when the Clean Water Act and when it was first presented, when it was voted in, and then some of its amendments, it had come with these big funding projects, and there was a lot of money that communities could have.
Right.
And I don't think the vision was ever that every little tiny town would have its own utility district.
Right.
You know, actually, the idea was that maybe we would have these more centralized systems, and it just never happened that way because there was so much money,
right,
and everybody could get a little bit of it, which is good.
Right.
But what happened was, you know, in this drive to create smaller government, that money went away.
Mm-hmm.
So you had these small municipalities stuck with some sewage treatment plants and drinking water plants that were expensive to maintain, and they didn't have the tax base.
Right.
Then they didn't have a funding pot to help them. And so these systems degrade. Now, I don't know if you heard what happened to that plant in Gatlinburg.
Yes, I did. I did. Yeah.
Yes. We were on site within 24 hours talking to people,
right,
and it was such a tragedy.
Right. They had a major failure of a storage facility that stored massive amounts of to be treated or partially treated sewage. And it just failed and dumped millions and millions of gallons of sewage into the river
and
killed a couple people, right?
Yeah. They were two investigators that were checking this wall that they had a question about. And while they were there, the wall collapsed.
Right, right.
And, you know, and it turned out to be an engineering failure, right. Which kind of goes to another subject about how we select municipal jobs. It's always the lowest bidder.
Right.
Sure. And this is what happens when you get the lowest bidder. Yeah. They had put structural beams farther apart to save money.
You know, that storage facility was not part of the initial development of that sewer mm-hmm. plant there.
Yeah.
That was built some years later as an alternative to expanding the plant. They just said, well, we just need to have a place to hold this material to process it timely. But as you say, they cut corners and I don't know. I'm sure there were many, many lawsuits involved in that, and I don't know how they were resolved. But
well, and that's the thing. You know, you're saving a buck now, you're going to pay, you know,
exactly.
$20 later.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Renee, we've gone for almost 40 minutes here, and it's been, the time has gone by. Let me ask you one last couple questions, and then we'll close up.
Okay.
You know, I think one of the themes that is going in our society these days with us COVID-19 and other in you know, climate change and things that where society and science sort of interface with one another, there seems to be some sort of a anti-science ethic, I don't, or lack of ethic out there. It's disturbing to me. Is there a thought about that?
Yeah, you know, I was just talking to a guy who had wrote a very prescient article about how the internet can create this kind of thing, that, you know, while the internet has all this great stuff, it can also create all these alternate realities. And then you find a community of people that kind of are believe in your alternate reality, and then suddenly, you know, we're not talking. And science used to be something that we could agree on to a certain degree. It's not a belief system. It's based on facts.
Right.
And there's, you know, it tells you uncomfortable truths sometimes.
Right.
And we've become a society that doesn't want to listen to uncomfortable truths. And so, you know, we want to reject the things that we don't fit, you know, our way of thinking. Instead of expanding our way of thinking, we contract our way of thinking. And
right.
I think it's unfortunate, but it's the reality of life now. And it's something that we have to deal with. And I always try to approach folks, you know, from a place of compassion about where they are in their, you know, and what scares them about science, and try to let them know that, you know, it's not anything to be afraid of. And it's a useful tool to protect us,
right.
Really.
Right. Renee, one last thing. What are you baking these days?
Oh my God. So I have gotten into the sourdough thing pretty heavily, like everybody else.
Right.
And yeah, so for a while I was failing so miserably at sourdough that I would just put it up on my Facebook page and have everybody analyze my failures. But then practice makes perfect. And now I'm making some really yummy bread.
Love that. You know, I've noticed you post a couple things on one of the sourdough Facebook groups.
Uh-huh.
And I got tickled. I don't know how you have time to be involved in baking with all that you're doing.
Well, I have to say, I almost posted this one picture of the sourdough in my compost because the whole thing's baked. And I thought, no, I don't want to gross anybody out of
no,
the compost.
It would have to be pretty bad to throw it away.
It didn't even rise. I mean,
uh-oh.
It was just a joke.
So. Call it a cracker.
I know, right?
You've developed a new form of sourdough cracker.
Yeah.
Renee, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real joy to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed every minute.
All right.